From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Ghost to Ghost. Here's what's happening. U.S. air safety regulators are preparing to issue warnings to pilots and airlines about potential interference with key cockpit safety systems by the new 5G wireless service, slated to go live as soon as early as next December. According to current and former government and aviation industry officials briefing on the matter, the FAA has been drafting a special bulletin and accompanying mandates that would say certain automated features used by pilots to help them fly and land planes could be affected by wireless towers on the ground transmitting the new 5G signals. The FAA actions aren't expected to be directed at consumers' use of cell phones. Now, the cockpit systems, commonplace in modern air travel, help planes land in poor weather, prevent crashes, avoid mid-air collisions. The FAA has determined that if commercial pilots aren't able to use their features, that could lead to flight cancellations, delays, or diversions in 46 of the country's largest metropolitan areas where towers are located. My gosh. Double vaccinated people are catching COVID and passing it on to those they live with, warn experts who have studied this problem in the United Kingdom. Individuals who have had two vaccine doses can be just as infectious, they say, as those who have not been jabbed. Shuttered firehouses, delayed trash pickups, fewer police officers and ambulances on the streets could be just days away now in New York City, as today a 5 p.m. deadline for municipal workers there to comply with the coronavirus vaccine mandate has passed. Thousands of workers had until 5 p.m. today to show proof that they've gotten at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Those who don't get on board will be placed on unpaid leave starting on Monday, a scenario that has labor unions warning of staffing shortages. What a mess. Let's check in with Advisor Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, this thing's getting out of hand, isn't it?
Well, George, I hate to say it. You know, this is a way for New York City to have massive budget cuts and massive layoffs without saying what's really going on. I think they knew when they did this that it would cause significant people to leave the police and fire and other municipal workforce. And if you look at what's been happening in the Going Direct reset, they've significantly destroyed their tax base. And so it was just a matter of time until that rolled into significant budget cuts. And this is how you do significant budget cuts without losing, what happened in Baltimore. Many of the businesses started to talk about, let's escrow our taxes and provide for private security. If the municipality is not going to do it, why should we pay taxes? But if you have excuses to your layoffs, then you have a better chance of continuing to collect taxes. So, you know, I hate to say this, I think this is in part a ruse.
Catherine, a number of states here in the United States are getting together to sue the Biden administration over their mandates. Is that going to hold up?
Well, if you look at what the law is, the emergency use authorization is illegal. And then with an emergency use authorization, mandating anything is illegal. So you've got two fundamental illegalities going on. And the question is, you know, can you find a clean court? If you can find a clean court, these mandates are not based in law.
Good point. Catherine, thanks so much. Have a happy Halloween. Great input from you. Queen Elizabeth II has been advised to rest for an additional 2 weeks and is therefore canceling more planned engagements, according to her doctor's orders. Buckingham Palace said that the 95-year-old monarch will be unable to travel at the recommendation of medical advisors. However, she will be able to continue undertaking light desk-based duties that include some virtual audiences. But my gosh, she's 95. Almost 40 years after his death following a bar brawl in Key Biscayne, Florida, Ricardo Morales, known as Monkey, contract CIA worker, anti-Castro militant, counterintelligence chief for Venezuela, FBI informant, and a drug dealer, returned to the spotlight when one of his sons made a startling claim on Spanish-language radio. Morales, a sniper instructor in the early 1960s in secret camps where Cuban exiles and others trained to invade Cuba, realized in the hours after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas in 1963 that the accused killer, Lee Harvey Oswald, had been one of his sniper trainees. Morales also told his two sons that 2 days before the assassination, get this, his CIA handler told him and his cleanup team to go to Dallas for a mission. But after the tragic events, they were ordered to go back to Miami without learning what the mission was all about. My gosh. Well, the sun launched a massive solar flare that's headed right toward planet Earth, the strongest storm seen in the current weather cycle. The volley of radiation may trigger the northern lights if it collides with our atmosphere, and they say could cause major issues for power grids. We've been talking about this for years. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with our friend, the retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who served in Vietnam and Iraq, Kevin Randall. Kevin, what do you have for us?
Well, good evening, George.
Hello, sir. Happy Halloween to you.
Well, same to you.
Thank you.
And I thought I'd do something a little different, especially with Halloween coming up.
Oh, really? What are you going to do for us?
Well, you've heard of those strange sightings of humans flying around without benefit of airplanes.
Yeah, we had some calls on that last night, as a matter of fact.
And with some of the most recent reports coming from the Los Angeles airport, I don't think the culprit in those cases have been found. It's just one of those bizarre things that are reported periodically.
You're right.
Looking at the videos and examining some of the documents, there was a suggestion at the sightings at LAX might have been a mannequin and a drone. I'm not convinced about that answer, though it seems more likely than some of the other answers that have been offered. David Jacobs, however, has suggested there is an alien presence on Earth and that hybrids that have human traits are walking among us. Some of these reports might be the result of that. One of the strangest of these sightings came from DeLand, Florida, during July of this year. The witness, known only as Larry, reported in a series of communications that there were strange, unidentified figures on the roof of the local courthouse. There was a suggestion that since there was nothing for the beings to stand on to look over a wall, these figures were 8 to 9 feet tall. Larry said that he reported this to the local police because the courthouse had been locked and there was no way for those beings to have get on the roof, though clearly, based on the pictures he took, they were there. And I'll post a link to the pictures on my blog. Larry also reported the sighting to his boss. Together, they spotted a figure and later a second one on the roof. His boss then called the police. The police investigated, found the doors had been properly locked, but there was no one on the roof. It was somewhat mysterious because no one had been seen to leave there. In the fourth report from Larry, he said that he'd seen a figure floating along the roof. He grabbed a camera and took more photographs of the figure. And then of another one, he said one figure approached the edge of the roof and seemed to be wearing a military-style hat. Another had a long neck and wore something about the neck. Larry noted again that the railing around the roof is 5 feet high and there's nothing to stand on near it. He concludes that the beings are very tall and remind him of what he'd read about the tall whites as related to UFO sightings. William Puckett has analyzed the pictures and he reported, and I quote, "I don't have any reason to believe this is a hoax report," end quote. There were other witnesses, there are photographs, and the witnesses did call the police. If this is a hoax, then the witnesses are not the perpetrators of it. This is just a very strange circumstance. While not exactly flying humanoids, this does fit into the pattern of strange beings, including the Mothman, in which John Keel reported in the 1960s. I confess, I don't know what to make of all of this. But I will note that there's photographic evidence of them, these beings. In a world of paranormal and UFOs, sometimes that's about all we can ask for. And that's what I have for Halloween, George.
All right, Kev, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week. Up next, Rick McCallum from the Hollywood Ghost Hunters joins us. His book is called Ghosts Believe in Me, and he's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our Halloween program. George Norrie with you. Later on in this hour, we'll have a surprise guest pop in for you, by the way. Let me tell you about Rick McCallum. Began his stunt career in 1982, performing a fight scene with Chuck Norris on the film Lone Wolf McQuade. Has more than 75-plus credits to his name, mostly in horror movies and also doubled for Daniel Baldwin, Barry Bostwick, Greg Evigan, Oliver Platt, Chris Noth, and many horror icons, including Kane Hodder, R.A. Mikhailoff, and Sid Haig, and as well as playing the monster in Deep Star 6, and he's been on our program before. And I remember our time on the haunted Queen Mary, Rick. We had a great time there. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was actually quite a good time on the Queen Mary. I really got to meet a person up in the green room, Stanton Friedman, who became a good friend of mine, and that's something to cherish.
That sure is. And how do you celebrate Halloween, Rick?
Well, if you think I'm going to put on a monster suit, boy, you're way off base.
you've had enough of monster suits before that.
I'll tell you. Yeah, I've probably played monsters in, I don't know, 20 movies. So, you know, when they're peeling the silicone off your face and it's glued on, you kind of lose a little of your enthusiasm for dressing up.
Absolutely. How's the book Ghosts Believe in Me doing?
It's actually doing very well, and I think a lot of that has to do with you guys. So thank you very much.
Well, you are very welcome. Let me ask you a quick question about this tragedy with Alec Baldwin, by the way. You've been on movie sets quite a bit. Isn't that a strange story?
Yeah, it is, and I think there's probably a lot more to be said about it.
I think so, too.
They get done going through it because, I mean, I've been on sets, you know, where we've had guns and things like that. And, I mean, the level of people keeping an eye on it was, you know, I kept an eye on it as stunt coordinator. The first AD, the assistant director, he kept an eye on it. The armorer kept an eye on it. And all three of us would look at it before it went to the person that was going to use it. And every single person was taught by the armorer the lines that they should be shooting, where they shouldn't be shooting, and the actors knew it and everything else. So there's a lot more to this story, I think, than we're hearing.
Is it very unusual to have a live round in a gun on a movie set?
Oh, yeah, you never have live rounds on there. I mean, you'll have, you know, half rounds and things like that are blanks.
This is
most
true.
Of the guns nowadays are just using flash barrels where they light up. You know, and then they just put the sound effects in and stuff later. But you never have real ammo on the set ever under any circumstance.
How about you? What's been the strangest thing that's happened with you on set?
As far as guns go or just...
Anything.
Well, one of the funniest things that happened was I was getting ready to go off the hood of a car going about 20 miles an hour into steel barrels. And you can always tell when it's going to be something dangerous because the whole crew and cast comes out to watch. And this one girl ran up to me, one of the actresses. She says, "Are you going to get hurt?" And I said, "Yes." She goes, "How bad?" I said, "Let you know in a couple of minutes." So, you know, that's just kind of what the whole thing is. I will say, though, we did have a case on the case with a gun where we had all checked it in. The actor said, "Can I look at it?" He opens it up and all the stuff falls out of the gun. We're okay, give that back to us now.
Tom Cruise does a lot of his own stunts, doesn't he?
Yeah, he actually does. You know, funny, but yeah, he does. Actually, one of my friends actually doubled him in some of the stuffs that the people wouldn't allow him to do. But he's actually a very talented guy. And I'll tell you who else was a very talented actor as far as stunts was Chuck Norris.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He was one of a kind, too. I miss that guy.
Yeah, he was actually, you know, he started off as a stunt guy, if I recall.
I think so. You're right. How did the Hollywood Ghost Hunters start?
Well, I had always had a fascination ever since I was 13 for the paranormal. And Kane and I and Ari Mihailov, who played Leatherface, we were doing a movie at Mansfield Prison. That's where they filmed The Shawshank Redemption.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay.
And it was late one night. It was like maybe 1 or 2 in the morning, and everybody else had gone home, and Kane and I were just digging around. And this is a while back. I had never told anybody about my interest in ghost hunting other than family and stuff like that. And as we're walking along through the cell block, Kane looks at me and he goes, "Hey, let's ghost hunt." And I was like, "Really?" So we started looking around, and, you know, we were getting little things happening there and there. And then we saw a shadow figure move down at the end of the hall. And I turned around to say something to Kane, and he was gone. And I thought to myself, "Oh, isn't this great? The big, scary Jason guy ran away, right?" And then I turned around, and he was actually going straight down the thing towards it. So I thought, you know, if I ever wanted to start a group, this is the guy that's got to be my partner. I mean, because I had other people that, you know, if a bug burped, they all went backwards, you know, so wanted somebody that went forward. And
yep, absolutely.
That's exactly what he is.
Are you still going to Scotland every year? And how come you still do that?
I love Scotland. I just have an affinity for it. I mean, I'm Scottish heritage. You know, the McCullums and the Malcolms are the exact same family. They just have split names. But yes, actually, I have a tour that I'm the ambassador for in July for 9 days that we're going to hit, you know, three of the best ghost hunting places and a whole bunch of castles and stuff. It's going to be a fantastic tour.
Do you find, Rick, that the United Kingdom has more haunted spots than the United States?
Oh, 10 to 1. At
wow.
least.
How come?
Well, they're a lot older than us.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of their, like in Scotland, Scotland has one of the bloodiest heritages, them and England. I mean, they were killing each other face to face out in the fields. I mean, that leaves an impression. You know, that's where you find a lot of the spirits. And I will also tell you, which is strange, that Scotland, England, Ireland, the other places I've been there, the intensity of the hunts is much higher than in the United States.
Do you do ghost hunting because it's fun or because you're really getting into it, or both?
Both. Actually, I'm very interested in trying to figure out exactly what it is. I mean, no matter how long you do it, and I've been doing it for a long, long time, you'll never know the real answer. I mean, you know, it's really strange, but it's exciting. I mean, just the other day, I was listening to an old thing from the Birdcage Theater in Tombstone. And I had set my camera downstairs in the brothel and poker area and went upstairs to talk to the owner. And as I was leaving, because so many people had been shot down there, I just asked him, I said, you know, did you get killed down here? Didn't hear anything. And I said, did you kill anybody down here? And I didn't hear anything. So I went back up and ghost hunted upstairs. And then Billy and I came down. And as we're coming down, there's a voice on the video that says, I had to.
Wow.
So
you captured an EVP sound.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I want to go back and try and find out who the person was that talked to me.
What kind of technical apparatuses do you bring, Rick?
Oh, I bring not quite as much as everybody else does, because I do think that ghost hunting is getting a little off, you know, offline with all of the equipment they're bringing out. I usually bring a K2 meter, which picks up electromagnetic field. I bring a voice recorder, a spirit box, a REM pod, which will pick up, you know, if there's anything in the area. And I use thermal image cameras. They're, so you can see in the dark. So they're pretty good.
Is it sometimes dangerous to go ghost hunting?
Yes, absolutely. And on many different ways, many different levels. You're walking around in the dark, and a lot of the stuff I've done in Scotland is outdoors, or they're ruins. So you're walking around in the dark, you know, there's rocks and boulders and holes, and I mean, you better be paying attention there. And then there's always the possibility that something will attach to you, which I had happened to me in Ireland.
Oh, geez.
And, yeah. I don't wish that on anybody.
And do you sometimes bring that attachment home with you?
I have not. I have had things show up here, but I haven't brought anything home with me. So,
what has been for you the most scariest thing that has happened?
Well, a couple things. The last thing that happened to me at Lepp Castle in Ireland, I felt like I had been shot through the eye.
Oh, my God.
And my legs buckled, my eyes started watering, I grabbed onto the car, and then I started staggering backwards, and I looked down, and I said, you know what, Rick, you've been doing stunts for 40 years, fall down while you're still, you know, conscious.
Right.
So I started to do it, and I heard a voice say to me, it says, if you hit the ground, you'll never get up. So I kind of threw it into reverse and went back and was able to grab onto the car, and one of my buddies from Scottish Paranormal come running out and grabbed me, was helping me, you know, stand up and gave me water and stuff. And it was cold and windy. I said, just leave me out here so, you know, I'll feel better. So we finally got our chance to go into the castle, and I was sitting there, and I just said, guys, just leave me in the car. And while I was there, my vision started to go. And then, remember the old iris on the old movies that said, that's the end of the movie?
Yeah.
My eyes did that.
Oh, my gosh.
I went, oh, this is not a good sign, right? So I just said, you know, I said, look, I've got to do a lot of stuff nobody ever does. I've done most everything I wanted to do, and if today's my day, I'm okay with it. And about 5 minutes later, I was fine. And I mean, I was seriously thought that that was it for me. And the thing that really got my attention the most was several weeks later, I got a call from somebody in Scotland. They said, we found out at the place we just been to before, two guys had had a duel, and one guy got shot through the right eye.
You were feeling that too. Rick, stay with us. We're going to bring in a special guest in a moment. You'll be staying with us. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Tim Banal is our editor of Coast to Coast AM, and every week he puts together some great stories. What do you have for us this week, Timothy?
Hey, George, how you doing?
Happy weekend. You too, my friend.
We got a couple of wild ones for you tonight. I think you're really going to like them. The first one I think most people can identify with, I think. So out there in Colorado earlier this month, a hiker, he gets reported missing on the state's Mount Elbert, which is the tallest mountain in the state. So he's missing. And the Lake County Search and Rescue Department dispatches a team to go and find him. They look for him overnight for about 4 hours. Second team goes out looking for him in the morning. And that effort's cut short when they find out that he's returned to his hotel. So they go over to the hotel and they ask him, what happened. And he explains that, he got lost, but eventually found his way back to a trail that led to his car. It lasted about 24 hours, but, he was a little shaken up, but he was fine. And he didn't know anyone was looking for him. And they thought that was very strange because they said, "We've been calling you all night on your cell phone." And he said, "Oh, I didn't answer the phone number because I didn't recognize it, and I assumed it was some kind of spam." So I think everyone has gotten those unidentified phone numbers.
Oh, yeah, too many robocalls.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But apparently, even when you're missing and stranded in the middle of the night on a mountain, you don't take the call. How they want to pitch you on renewing your car warranty, I guess, right?
That's funny.
All right, now this next one, George, I know this is ghost to ghost tonight, but this might be the scariest story you hear all evening. So this woman in Thailand, she's been charged with attempted murder following just a wild stunt, wild move on her part. So we begin the story here with a couple of painters. They're working on a high-rise building, apartment building, and they're looking for a crack to fix outside on the facade of the building. So they're lowering themselves down on a board. Now, we're not talking about like what they use at the Empire State Building here. This isn't some kind of sophisticated operation. This is a board with pulleys, and it's just terrifying in and of itself to be on one of these things, I would assume. You wouldn't catch me on one. So they're lowering themselves down, and they're at about the 32nd floor, and they feel this tug on the rope. And they look down, and a woman on the 21st floor has reached out the window, grabbed the rope, and cut it. So these painters now realize that they are stuck outside the building because this is the rope that would bring them to the ground. So they are now stuck at about the 26th floor of the high-rise apartment building. And there's video at the Coast to Coast AM website of them in a panic outside of the apartment building. Luckily, they eventually got the attention of someone living on the 26th floor of the building, and they jumped from the board to the balcony, managed to safely get back to, quote-unquote, terra firma, I guess you could say, back on the balcony of the building. And police tracked down the woman, and she's been charged with attempted murder. Her reasoning for all this was that she was aggravated that they were doing work outside of her window, and she decided to cut the cord, so to speak.
I love it. Great job, Tim.
Thanks a lot, George. Have a great weekend.
Great stories. Have a great Halloween. Just go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, and read the stories that Tim has picked up and has rewritten and put on the website. They're really amazing. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Rick McCallum with us from the Hollywood Ghost Hunters. The Conjuring is a 2013 American supernatural horror film directed by James Wan and written by Chad Hayes and Kerry Hayes. It is the inaugural film of the Conjuring Universe franchise. Patrick Wilson, whom I knew when he was 6 years old because I worked with his father here in St. Louis, and Vera Farmiga star as Ed and Lorraine Warren, paranormal investigators that you've heard so much about on this program, and authors associated with prominent cases of haunting. Their purportedly real-life reports inspired the Amityville horror story and the film franchise, of course. The Warrens come to the assistance of the Perrin family, who experienced increasingly disturbing events in their farmhouse in Rhode Island back in 1971. Our surprise guest with us is one of the daughters of the Perrins, of course. They had five daughters, of course, and Andrea Perrin is with us right now, noted author. She's got five books out, and one of them, of course, includes House of Darkness, House of Light. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Hello, George. Oh, it's so nice to hear your voice and speak with you again. We met in person a few years ago.
Yep.
You know, prior to the COVID outbreak, at the Starworks Symposium. I was very impressed with your presence at the symposium. You had so much to contribute.
Well, you've had so much to contribute too, Andrea. I mean, with what you went through, are your parents still with us, or have they passed on?
Yes. No. In fact, my parents are 86 and 82. My father just turned 86 August 27th, and my mom is 82 August 24th. And I was with both of them tonight, one virtually and one in person, because we're doing a special live stream investigation of the farmhouse where I grew up this Halloween weekend. So my whole family has been together, three of us virtually from Georgia, and the others, my father and my sister Nancy, are with me. And we got some off-the-charts evidence at that farm tonight. And they were really smart. They did a baseline before they would even let us in the house, because they figured as soon as we got in the house that it would really activate the place, which it proved to do. So we're into night one of a 72-hour virtual live stream for this weekend. It's been very exciting.
You were a little teenager when your family moved into the farmhouse. Your mother wanted to get out there into the wild, and what, it was like a 200-acre place, wasn't it?
Yes, the old Arnold Estate. It was one of the original colonial homes in the colony of Rhode Island. It was completed as it stands now in 1736, 40 years before the signing of the Declaration of Independence.
I had heard, Andrea, that when your parents bought the farmhouse, the person who sold it to them said, "And don't forget to keep the lights on at night." Did he really say something like that?
Yes, he took my father for a walk, and he said, "Roger, for the sake of your family, leave the lights on at night." But he was an elderly gentleman, Mr. Earl Kenyon. He loved our family. He wanted us to have it. And I think that it was his forewarning. We didn't understand. My dad didn't know how to interpret what he said. He figured it was a new, even though it's a very old house, it was new to us. And all the bedrooms for the girls were upstairs, and there was only one bathroom downstairs. So the best way to keep your girls from tumbling down those stairs was to leave some lights on. But we soon discovered from people that lived in the area that those lights were on in that house 24/7, every light in the house. And I think that's how he kept the activity at bay.
Was the representation in the movie The Conjuring pretty close to what was really happening to you and your family?
George, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. It's about 95% fiction.
Really?
Yes. James Wan read my books, House of Darkness, House of Light. It's a trilogy, three volumes. It blew his mind. He's like, we cannot include this in the movie. What is the point of making a movie that no one will stay to watch till the end? And so Chad and Carrie Hayes, both very talented screenwriters who also read my books, kind of cherry-picked a little of this and a little of that. And of course, the entire Conjuring series is based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren. So it wasn't supposed to be based on my books, but I think it's one of the few times in Hollywood history where the actual story is toned down to the point where it's virtually unrecognizable. They were just, they're fear-based carbon units too. They're not exempt. And they were just afraid to tell the truth. This is a case where the truth is literally stranger than fiction. So they opted to go with the fiction.
I miss Ed and Lorraine Warren. If anybody should be able to come back from the other side, it's those two, don't you think?
I would certainly think so, yes. And you know what? They have made their presence known in some very unique ways. So we'll have to have a whole nother talk about that someday, George.
Absolutely.
We'll fill a show with just what we've experienced of our family. I truly believe that they loved us, and they were concerned, and they cared. And Lorraine told me 40 years after the fact that they were in over their heads. They just didn't know it. They had never encountered anything like what they did in our home.
What do you think happened at that location a long time ago?
I don't know, and I wish that I could answer that, and I don't know that that anyone could. I think it's part of the history and mystery of life itself,
mm-hmm.
that these are not questions that will be answered in this realm, possibly in the next, but it doesn't even matter to me who these spirits were in life. It matters that they still are in afterlife. To me, that is the mystery and the magic and the miracle.
Is the farmhouse still there?
Oh, yes. I was there today, all day. Well, and yesterday and the day before. It's just as beautiful and welcoming. And I love it there, George. It's the only place I've ever felt at home in my life. It's permanent, where everything else feels temporary.
So the family still owns it, huh?
Pardon?
The family still owns it?
No, we sold it in 1980.
Ah, okay.
My mother felt that she just couldn't live there anymore, that she'd just been through enough. And my mother really did go through hell in that house.
I bet.
There was one particular spirit. Most of them were benign or benevolent, but there was one in particular that really loathed my mother and threatened her and harmed her on several occasions. And she'd had it. She just wanted to move on and start a new life. And we did. We sold the farm in 1980 to the abutting landowners in Massachusetts. And our family moved to Georgia. But my mother said something very prophetic at the time. And that was, we can leave the farmhouse, but the farmhouse will never leave us.
Wow. Wow. And you, as you said, you were there today. Are you, you're not scared?
Oh, God, no. No, I never had any altercations with the spirits. What frightened me was seeing what was happening to other members of my family, especially my mother and my sister, Cindy. And Cindy had briefly passed away when she was 2 months old and had been brought back. And I think that's one of the reasons that she was a target in the house, because she had already been to the other side and had returned. And I think in some way there was some point of recognition, if that makes any sense.
Sure does.
They would try to communicate with her and contact her. And sometimes, well, for instance, the second night that we lived in the house was the first night that she came running into my bedroom and crawled into bed with me. And she said, Annie, I hear voices all around my bed. They're all around my bed. They're all talking together. They're all saying the same thing. The next logical question is, Cindy, what are they saying? And her response was, there are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. There are seven dead soldiers buried in the wall. And they said it over and over, and it got louder and louder. And she said, I can't believe nobody else can hear this. How can no one else hear this? And when I was writing my books, like 30 years later, I was sitting with Cindy making sure that everything I wrote was accurate according to her account. And I just looked at her and I said, honey, how many times did that happen during the 10 years that we lived there? And her eyes welled with tears and she said, thousands.
My God. Now, did anybody ever check the walls to see if there were seven dead soldiers there?
Actually, they're clapboard walls. There is no insulation. So there was no conceivable way that soldiers could have been buried in the house. but the owners now had some ground-penetrating radar put down on the property down near one of the stone walls at the base of the hill, and they came up with some very peculiar anomalies down there. And, you know, George, it makes perfect sense, because when think about it, this house survived the Revolutionary War, the Civil War. It was part of the Underground Railroad because the Arnold family were Quakers and abolitionists. There were the Dorr Rebellion, the French-Indian War. I mean, there were skirmishes, border skirmishes. It makes perfect sense that there are even holes in the back of the house where a musket could be put through to protect the property at the top of the hill going all the way down into the acreage. So it stands to reason that they were buried there, separated from their families, and were seeking solace and some closure.
Would your mother ever go back there, even to visit?
No, sir.
No, no way.
Nope. And she said it on the live stream tonight, bless her sweetheart, when we left that house in June of 1980, she just turned and looked as we were driving away, and she said to me, "I will never return to this property. Never." And she has been true to her word ever since.
You can't blame her.
No.
Cannot blame her. How about your dad? Would you go back?
He loves it. He's there with me too. We're in Harrisville. We're in Harrisville.
He's there now.
Right now.
Wow.
Yep.
That is something else. Would you go through this experience again?
Absolutely.
My
Absolutely, as difficult as it was. And you know what? Even my mother said, as hard as it was, she learned everything she needed to know about life and death and the afterlife living in that house, and has no fear of death, because as far as she is concerned and as far as the rest of us are concerned, we know there is something beyond our mortal existence. And the only reason that we can say that is knowledge, not faith or belief or wishful thinking. Knowledge is because we lived in that house for a decade.
Andrea, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with you and Rick McCallum and take phone calls next hour here on Coast to Coast. Andrea is one of five sisters, part of the Perrin family, that lived in that house where the movie The Conjuring was created all about. That came out in 2013. Up next, your phone calls with Rick McCallum on Ghost Hunting with Andrea about The Conjuring, next on Coast to Coast AM.